Case number 12-5339, William Havens, Appellant v. Raymond Edwin Mavis, Jr., Secretary of the Navy, Chairman, Board of Corrections of Naval Records. Mr. Wells for the Appellant, Ms. Seo for the Appellee.
Mr. Wells, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
If you would indulge me 1 second, I would like to note for the record that this is the first time, I believe, that three former district judges have sat on this court in a panel as long as any of us can remember. And
if it previously occurred, it would have been back in the days of Judge Pan, Judge Wright, and Judge Spotswood Robinson. We know it has not occurred at any time since then.
All right, I was just going to say, speaking for myself, I think it augurs great things for our court.
I couldn't agree more.
Okay. Judge Sentell? Is that unanimous?
Unanimous.
The parties agree also, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Your Honor, I think perhaps the most important issue here is whether or not this case is Smalls, and if so, what part of Smalls it is, because there are some significant differences, as you know. When you heard Smalls, they came up with two district courts, District Court of Hawaii and D.C., with the same jurisdiction, or same jurisdictional requirements, and both cases in both courts, Smalls asked for money. That's not the case here. We're significantly different. First of all, we're dealing with an Article III court with general jurisdiction, which does have APA jurisdiction, Administrative Procedure Act jurisdiction, against a court of limited jurisdiction, Article I, on the other hand, with the Court of Federal Claims, which does not enjoy APA jurisdiction, and in fact is limited by the law to seeking monetary claims.
But isn't it a fact that the Court of Federal Claims can exercise jurisdiction over APA claims under some circumstances, and the Federal Circuit has so held?
Actually, Judge, what it says is that they can use equitable rights ancillary to their monetary jurisdiction. But the first thing that has to be found is Tucker Act jurisdiction. They have no primary equitable or declaratory judgment jurisdiction. And the Federal Circuit has also held, as you know, we've mentioned in the briefs, that the Court of Federal Claims has no APA jurisdiction in itself. It's where an Article III district court has primary APA jurisdiction, Court of Federal Claims can't. Now, what they do, and what sometimes leads to some confusion in practicing in that court, is they will apply similar standards, such as the arbitrary capricious standard, substantial evidence standard, and contrary to law and regulations. But the court itself and the Federal Circuits have agreed that there is no primary APA jurisdiction. In short, if I brought an APA case in the Court of Federal Claims, they'd send me packing.
And what about the Martinez case from the Federal Circuit?
Well, Martinez, I think that when the appellees cited to Martinez, they were kind of cherry-picking and making a leap of faith as to the jurisdiction, or as to the APA jurisdiction issue. Martinez did not find that the Court of Federal Claims had APA jurisdiction. What Martinez found was that they could act if ancillary to. They also said that there may be a possibility of APA jurisdiction, but my memory of Martinez, and I've kind of followed that case fairly closely, is that at no time did it come out and say the Court of Federal Claims can hear an APA case that's brought before them. And in fact, in the case of Martinez, was also a Tucker Act case. The issue there was whether or not going to the correction boards actually told the statute of limitations. Every other circuit says it does. The Federal Circuit ruled that it did not, and the reason they ruled it did not is because it's a different issue. Rather than coming back and reviewing the correction board's action, their primary jurisdiction is monetary issue brought under the Tucker Act, and so therefore going to the BCNR or any correction board did not toll the statute of limitations. In fact, uniquely in the Federal Circuit, you are not required to exhaust your administrative remedy by going to the correction board. There is no requirement to go to the correction board, and when I do Court of Federal Claims cases, I normally don't. Here in most of the other circuits, I have to show that either, you know, that it's be futile to go to the selection board or other good reason for not, I said selection board, I meant correction board, or other good reasons to go to not have to exhaust the administrative remedies. Was that responsive, Judge?
Yes.
Okay.
No, the Court of Claims does have the jurisdiction to consider correction of records, and so did I hear you correctly that you don't? Did you, in this case, on behalf of Mr. Havens, ask not just for the disability retirement and the monetary relief, but also did you not ask for correction of the military record in the Court of Claims?
That's correct. Okay. But
and why not? And that's what I thought you said. Why don't you, or why didn't you?
We did ask for a correction, but only as ancillary to the monetary claim. The primary claim was for the back pay and benefits. Okay. In order to do that, the court has no choice but to direct the Navy to correct the records. Otherwise, they can't pay it. So it's kind of it's more of a process than a substantive issue. That makes some sense.
So it's ancillary that is automatic. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. That's the only way they can do it.
All right.
In fact, the Federal Circuit also indicated that just because you ask for a record correction under 1552, that itself is not money mandating statute. And in fact, 10 U.S.C. 1552 is not a money mandating statute.
Okay. But you, in your complaint before the Federal Circuit, which I think is attached to as an appendix to the appellee brief, the red brief, your prayer for relief wasn't just for money. It was to direct that your client be evaluated to determine whether he was fit for release for active duty. And then in the alternative, you had a request for relief to modify a decision of the Physical Evaluation Board from January 2nd of 2002. And then in the alternative, that the matter be remanded to the BCNR for review and evaluation. So
yes, sir.
This wasn't just a complaint for money damages. There was also a complaint for equitable relief, right?
Well, not exactly, sir. Again, we're kind of going into the ancillary. We asked for the Physical Evaluation Board to be modified so that he would be granted, if you read on with that sentence, it's at Appendix 56, that he'd be granted benefits or separation pay pursuant to the second half instruction, and they would have to modify the PEB in order to do that. That's the only way they can do it. And the same with the process pursuant to the disability evaluation system. There's no way that they can pay him without those doing these things. For example, I just had a case where a Navy officer was discharged, okay? In order to pay the claim, which we won the case, in order to pay the claim, okay, they had to bring him effectively back on active duty, pay him until his retirement date, and then retire him. It's the only way the law allows him to do it. And I'm into my rebuttal time.
Go ahead. I do have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
On this, under 1491.2, it says that the, this is dealing with the Court of Claims, to provide an entire remedy and to complete the relief afforded by the judgment, which is what you were talking about, the court may issue orders directing restoration, claimant in placement in appropriate duty, and correction of applicable records. So it sounds like it's in its discretion, but you read this to mean this is not only automatic but required.
Yes, ma'am. It's the only way they can do it, Judge. It's because okay. They've got to go change the records. If they don't change the records or modify the records, then it's sitting out there saying he's not eligible for this, but we're paying for his. Why? So it's and that's the reason behind it. I think that's what the Federal Circuit has also held in the cases we've cited in the brief.
Okay.
May I retain the rest for rebuttal?
We'll give you a couple minutes, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Michelle Seo, Special Assistant U.S. Attorney, appearing today on behalf of the government. I will argue today that the District Court correctly dismissed Mr. Havens' amended complaint as barred by the principle of res judicata and consistent with this Court's precedent in Smalls v. United States, which is dispositive to this action. The main issue here is whether a service member who received an adjudication on the merits of his claim before the Court of Federal Claims can then bring the same claim with the same goal to be heard again before the District Court, an issue of res judicata, which in the context of this case requires first the same claim or cause of action as the prior action, second, a final judgment on the merits, and third, such judgment by a court of competent jurisdiction. Two major points exist which clearly demonstrate that Mr. Havens' claim was correctly dismissed by the District Court. First, this Court's precedent in Smalls, with its factual and procedural similarities, is dispositive to the present case and requires that a claim found barred by the statute of limitations by the Federal Circuit, then later repackaged and brought before the District Court as an APA claim, be barred by the principle of res judicata.
Second, it seems that there are two main ways, there may be more, but two that I see that the appellant is trying to distinguish Smalls. The first is that the argument that notwithstanding your citation to Martinez, the Court of Federal Claims was not a court of competent jurisdiction, and what's your response to that?
Well, Your Honor, the government believes that the Court of Federal Claims was a court of competent jurisdiction in this case because for the reasons stated in Martinez and for under 28 U.S.C. 1491A2, which states that equitable relief ancillary to a monetary claim can be granted by the Court of Federal Claims. As a result, the claim which was brought by Mr. Havens in the Court of Federal Claims, the relief he sought there is basically the same relief that he seeks as an APA claim here. So they would have had jurisdiction in the Court of Federal Claims. As counselor for Mr. Havens stated, they would have had jurisdiction to correct his records, given that the claim before the Court of Federal Claims was brought properly under a money mandating statute.
Can I just be clear on what your position is? Are you saying that Martinez stands for the proposition that they had jurisdiction over his APA claim, if he had brought one, or are you saying that they had jurisdiction to grant the same form of relief that he could obtain from an APA claim? Which argument are you making?
The argument that we are making is that Martinez stands for the proposition that they would be able to grant the same relief that he seeks under the APA claim because they had jurisdiction ancillary to the money claim for the same equitable relief. So not that Martinez grants APA jurisdiction, that's not what we're arguing here. That the relief he seeks before the District Court is essentially the same kind of relief that was available to him before the Court of Federal Claims is ancillary to his monetary claim.
Okay.
The second point is that under the analysis of res judicata, the elements at issue clearly show that the District Court correctly dismissed Mr. Havens' claim. Mr. Havens' claim involved the same claim or cause of action as his prior action before the Court of Federal Claims. In Smalls, this court determined, using the transactional analysis, that the claim there sought the same goal of having disability benefits for the plaintiff in Smalls. Here, similarly, Mr. Havens, in the Court of Federal Claims, sought money that flowed from being considered disability retired. Here, before this circuit, Mr. Havens seeks a correction that he is disability retired such that money benefits would flow, such that disability retirement benefits would flow from that. Essentially, the same relief that is sought. Thus, he brought a claim under the same claim or cause of action. In addition, the Court of Federal Claims, their statute of limitations dismissal constituted a final valid judgment on the merits for purposes of res judicata. And lastly, the Court of Federal Claims, as previously discussed, was a court of competent jurisdiction when it made that statute of limitations dismissal.
Let me ask you about the decision on the merits, because in the Court of Claims, it was a 12-1 dismissal, which is jurisdictional. And we've held, and I know Smalls is goes the other way, but I think it can be distinguished, but that a jurisdictional statute of limitations violation is not, I mean, a dismissal is not preclusive. And since we know that's how the Court of Claims handled this case, that is, on a jurisdictional statute of limitations dismissal, how is this a decision on the merits, the Court of Claims decision? I know you're going to rely on Smalls, but why don't you just put Smalls to the side for a minute?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that it's adjudication on the merits for the purposes of res judicata. And this is because the Court of Federal Claims enjoys exclusive jurisdiction for which their statute of limitations provides a limited waiver of sovereign immunity. As a result, this court's precedent in Tootle and Smalls, I won't discuss Smalls as requested, in Tootle and Smalls provides a path forward for litigants such as Mr. Havens. Litigants who have chosen the Court of Federal Claims and its exclusive jurisdiction have then indicated, at least in this instance with Mr. Havens, that he seeks the disability benefits which flow from a determination that he is disability retired. Thus, if he brings the same claim or cause of action that was adjudicated before the Court of Federal Claims, which was deemed to be barred by the statute of limitations due to the limited waiver of sovereign immunity for monetary benefits within their exclusive jurisdiction, then this court's precedent dictates that it would be barred by res judicata. Mr. Havens chose to fully adjudicate his claim before the Court of Federal Claims and appealed to the Federal Circuit and also petitioned for writ of certiorari before the Supreme Court. In doing so, he subjected himself to the exclusive jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims. If for the purposes of res judicata, with its principles of finality, this court, if they found that such a claim could then be brought, which would grant the same relief that he could have had before the Court of Federal Claims, the determination of disability benefits and a correction to his records from which the monetary benefit would then flow, this could undermine the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims and the precedent this court sets forth in stating that if a litigant chooses an APA forum and pleads as such, then they would have a forum to do so. Here, Mr. Havens first chose the Court of Federal Claims and its exclusive jurisdiction.
Can I just ask you why the appellant argues that Simtek precludes a finding that this was an adjudication on the merits because of a dismissal without prejudice is not an adjudication on the merits, at least according to language in Simtek. Why should that not concern us?
Well, Your Honor, the case in Simtek dealt with an issue different than the issue before the court here. It dealt with whether federal court decision would have claim preclusive effect in state courts. In addition, the discussion indicates that the adjudication on the merits under 41B doesn't necessarily entitle a decision to claim preclusive effect. It is a dismissal with prejudice, but that is only a necessary, not a sufficient condition, with prejudice in the sense that it's the same claim before the same court. So the treatises that are cited there, although not a part of this record, also indicate that the use of 41B for res judicata purposes as a hard and fast rule is very difficult to do due to the varying factors surrounding res judicata and finality analysis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The government would ask that if there are no further questions, that this court, the government requests that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, why don't you take two?
Your Honor, if I may, as to whether or not this was a dismissal with or without prejudice, on page 19 of the opening brief, we detailed the Court of Federal Claims' own decisions on that, and I realize you're not bound by them as a matter of comedy. We'd ask you give them heavy weight, which basically says that jurisdictional dismissal is not a dismissal with prejudice, it's dismissal without prejudice. As to the issue of the APA jurisdiction ancillary relief, I think perhaps the best description came from the Court of Claims itself, or Court of Federal Claims itself, and we cited that at the bottom of page 20, top of page 21 on the opening brief, and I don't want to read from the brief, but basically it says that you can't get to equitable relief, declaratory relief, until you can get to the monetary issue. And if there's no monetary issue, then you don't get to equitable or declaratory relief, and the court doesn't have that equitable or declaratory jurisdiction. So the situation we are in here now is before the Court of Federal Claims could do that, they would have had to find a Tucker Act issue and prevail under the Tucker Act. They never made the Tucker Act. They never got to the Tucker Act inquiry because they dismissed on statute of limitations. So therefore, I don't see how we could have had a same cause or same issues. And in that respect, we're nowhere near the res judicata. And finally, I would note that if you look at how the other circuits have held and how the restatement of judgments have held on dealing with these res judicata matters, they basically say if the other court didn't have jurisdiction to hear the case that's now pending before the second court, there is no res judicata, and we would ask
that
you give them way.
How do you distinguish Smalls?
We distinguish Smalls because Smalls, first of all, came up with the two courts that are both Article III courts. Both of them asked for money. If we had asked for money under the Little Tucker Act, for example, in the district court, that particular issue would have certainly been res judicata or collateral estoppel. But here, there was many more similarities, almost complete similarities, between the Hawaii court and the D.C. court, where in our case, we're looking at money-mandating Tucker statute versus APA review of the Board for Correction Records. And, Judge, I'd be the first one to say that the system of how this is set up leads us to this problem, but that's a congressional action that's going to have to change to probably give the Court of Federal Claims some APA jurisdiction in certain cases. They haven't done that, so we're stuck with the system that we have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would ask that you reverse the court below.
Thank you.